Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Today we bring you number 10 in our series of 11 CNE programs from the 2025 Oncology Nursing Society Annual Congress in Denver. Our group has been participating in the ONS Congress for 17 years, and this program focuses on the role of bispecific T-cell antibodies in the management of small cell lung cancer. Our nursing faculty included Ms. Elizabeth Krueger from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and Ms. Beth Sandy from the Aberson Cancer Center in Philadelphia. Our oncologist faculty were Dr. Ann Chang from the Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut, and Dr. Aaron Schenk from the University of Colorado Ann Schutz Medical Campus in Aurora, Colorado. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. And consider that in these meetings, we may discuss the use of agents and treatments that are not approved, so check out the prescribing information for more. To begin our program, I asked Dr. Chang to describe the mechanism of action of bispecific T-cell antibodies.
The way that I think about it is there's two heads on the antibody. One recognizes a protein on the surface of the tumor cell, and the other recognizes a protein on the surface of the T-cell. So you're really physically bringing the immune system over to the tumor cell. And that's really important, for example, in small cell. It's a tumor that's kind of a cold tumor. And if you look at tissue sections, there are really not a lot of infiltrating lymphocytes there. So this way you can bring the immune system, induce T-cell proliferation, activation, and cell death.
I'm curious, Beth, how you explain it to patients. Recently I heard somebody talk about Lady and the Tramp, the scene where they share the spaghetti, you know?
That
was pretty good. How do you explain to a patient what a bispecific is?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get to that level, you know, and start talking about the Y-shaped antibody and everything. But what I'll say to the patient is that this antibody is going to help bring your immune system, get that activated so that it can kill your cancer. So it's going to work that way, as opposed to how chemotherapy may go in and kind of do a search and destroy mission for a lot of different things.
So, as I mentioned, bispecifics are being used, different types of bispecifics. These are the so-called CD3 bispecifics, specifically trying to engage a T-cell. We see this being used in acute lymphocytic leukemia. Also, as I mentioned, in multiple myeloma, two different targets that they have on these bispecifics, both approved now in myeloma, being used pretty frequently. Also in lymphoma, as I said, we're going to talk about this Saturday night. We have several bispecifics now approved and several others in development. And, you know, I guess these are now offering very similar kind of a strategy in a way, a T-cell based to CAR T therapy, which we were talking a little bit about last night in our CLL session. There are also other types of bispecifics that are being used in solid tumors. And you see tarlatamab there, and there's another one there for uveal melanoma. Dementifusp, that are, again, these CD3 T-cell engagers. But also in lung cancer, this is non-small cell lung cancer, we have amivantanab, Aaron, and this is not immune. It hits two parts, the EGFR and the c-MET. And you see a different spectrum of side effects. This is used in EGFR mutant disease, which, again, we talked about a couple of days ago. Aaron, any comments about what you see with tolerability and side effects with this antibody that targets two parts, two different targets?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we give this pretty regularly in practice, and there's a lot of challenges with both the EGFR side effects, particularly the skin dermatologic toxicity, and you can also see some side effects with the MET portion of amivantamab as well, some of the swelling and edema that happens with inhibiting MET. So it's a challenging therapy to give, not only because of the side effect profile long-term, but more immediate as well with the infusion-related reactions.
So really amazing what's going on in oncology today. Now we've done programs just on biliary tract cancer, which we never used to talk about, and they have kind of a similar strategy with a bispecific hitting two parts of the HER2. On Wednesday, we were talking about TDXD, which is used in many cancers, including non-small cell lung cancer, targeting HER2. But in biliary tract cancer, and probably going to be coming into other cancers, we have zanidatamab, which is a really exciting new bispecific targeting two parts of the HER2 molecule. So I guess, Liz, one of the key issues here for these CD3 agents, bispecifics, like tarlatamab, is cytokine release syndrome. Again, we talked a little bit about this last night when we were talking about CAR T therapy. When I first heard about tarlatamab in small cell, I'm like, wow, that's an interesting thought, trying to, I imagine, a sick patient, a smoker, cardiovascular, things that you don't typically see in myeloma and lymphoma. I'm like, wow, I wonder how that's going to work out. But can you talk a little bit, Liz, about your, kind of how you visualize cytokine release syndrome?
Sure. So this is an example of an educational slide we provide our patients with. We talk to them about the CRS symptoms being worse at the beginning, typically with treatment number one and treatment number two. And those consist of potential for fever, low blood pressure, tiredness, shortness of breath, and hemodynamic instability. And because of those reasons, we admit them to the hospital on cycle 1, day 1, and cycle 1, day 8 for monitoring. We found that some of the CRS symptoms can typically occur about 13 or so hours after administration of the drug. So it's not doesn't happen right away. It happens many hours later. So that's something that we like to prepare the patients for as well.
And this will come out more. Again, it's really great to have the opportunity to spend a little. We've been rushing through so many things here this week. I feel like I'm short of breath just when listening to all this stuff. But we're going to be able to present four cases today and really hopefully get into a little more granularity about how things play out with this interesting agent. Aaron, can you discuss a little bit about the sort of the pathophysiology of cytokine release syndrome, like what's going on?
Sure. Some of the information that we have, what we think's happening, is just the immediate activation of the immune system releases a number of cytokines that really stimulate a larger response within the body. So the as my colleagues described, the way I like to describe it is that the bispecific is two sticky ends, and sometimes when it first goes into the patient, it's really pulling in those immune cells and activating the immune system. Some of the pathophysiology we think is around IL-6 release, and that's one of the things that we give an anti-IL-6 antibody, tocilizumab, to help reduce the symptoms of cytokine release syndrome.
So, Ann, can you talk a little bit about what tocilizumab is, how it works, when you use that, when you use steroids for cytokine release, and sort of the spectrum of what you see? These people can end up in the ICU with hypotension, et cetera.
Sure. So if you have grade 1 or 2 CRS and you're looking for fever, plus or minus hypotension, or you can have hypoxia, that typically you're using supportive care, so Tylenol, IV fluids, oxygen. If you get to grade 3 and you really need vasopressor support, or if you need usually for grade 2, you may also consider using steroids. So that's sort of supportive care, then steroids. Then if you get to grade 3, that's when you usually use the tocilizumab. That's the IL-6 directing. Preventing the IL-6 from being expressed or the actions of that. So that's sort of the level. Supportive care, then steroids, then tocilizumab. And all of these can be managed pretty well.
So, Aaron, what about neurologic issues that come from, again, in T-cell-based therapy and CAR-T, we see so-called ICANS that can have a variety of manifestations. We hear a lot less about that with bispecifics. I don't know if you actually can see that. Do you see neurologic issues?
I have had a patient who developed ICANS long-term on a DLL3 T-cell engager on a clinical trial. What was interesting in this case is that we think of CRS as, the major neurologic toxicity, and of course, it is. Especially if not intervened upon and treated. But there can also be ICANS that can happen later on in the course. So CRS is really a more early phase, immediate term side effect. But what the patient started experiencing was having trouble with some word finding over time and then some confusion. And she was able to come back to her neurologic baseline with steroid therapy.
And Beth, you know, again in CAR T, they want these patients to have a family member or friend available to pick up slight changes that might occur. I'm curious whether you've ever seen any neurologic issues. Also, how the issue of comorbidities ties in here. Again, when I think about small cell, I think about a heavy smoker, a lot of chronic obstructive lung disease, cardiovascular disease. How does that play out when you're using a therapy like this?
Yeah, for sure. So we're going to get into that in a couple of my case studies. But I worry sometimes about the ability to detect ICANS in our patients with small cell because many of them have brain mets, have been treated for brain mets. So there's underlying cognitive difficulties there as it starts. And I always say, you know, luckily, in the clinical trials with tarlatamab, it's been a little bit less than what they necessarily see in like CAR T therapy and things like that. But nonetheless, it occurs, and our ability to detect it may be a bit hampered by the comorbid conditions we typically see in patients with small cell.
So, Anne, we asked you, we're going to take a step back and then kind of talk a little bit about small cell in general, and then we'll sort of get into where tarlatamab fits in. But before you do, Aaron, I was just sort of flashing on the fact, I hear things here and there about CAR T and solid tumors. It's kind of, nothing's really approved at this point. Do you see CAR T coming into lung cancer at any point?
There may be a role for DLL3 CAR T therapy. Those are being investigated in clinical trials. There's also mesothelin CARs, not non-small cell lung cancer, but in mesothelioma being developed as well.
You know, of course, some of the results we've seen with CAR T therapy, particularly diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, were these people who previously really were end-stage disease, some of them are cured, not a small number, and we're hoping maybe this will end up in solid tumors as well, but let's see what happens. All right, Anne, let's take a step back, talk a little bit about small cell cancer, the biology, and how it presents.
Sounds good. Okay. So let's start with the incidence and risk factors. Small cell is about 14% of lung cancer. The rest is non-small cell. There are around 250,000 new cases and 200,000 deaths globally each year. And in the U.S., that's about 16,000 new cases last year. The median age at diagnosis is in the U.S. is 69 years. And it's pretty balanced between male and female. The big risk factor, of course, is smoking. 95% of patients have history of tobacco use. And I always counsel my patients around tobacco cessation because that can improve their lung function and their prognosis. So the rest, there's around 2.5 to 13% of patients who are never smokers. They sometimes have a better prognosis. And then rarely, we have non-small cell patients with driver mutations like EGFR that undergo histologic transformation to small cell as a mechanism of resistance. The characteristics, this is a rapidly growing tumor. It spreads you have early development of widespread metastases, and it's exquisitely sensitive to radiation and chemo. That picture is a picture of an H&E slide that shows small cell. There are small blue cells, very sparse cytoplasm. There's some nuclear molding, and 75% have are IHC positive for one of those neuroendocrine markers. In the 25 that aren't, we now have other ways to subtype them, including IHC markers for POU2F3. So staging in small cell is functional. So we have limited versus extensive. Limited stage is about 30% of the patients. It includes stage 1 through 3 in the TNM staging system. And this means that you can treat everything within one radiation field. So that typically includes everything within one hemothorax, and then lymph nodes you can now get include contralateral and sometimes supraclavicular. For extensive stage, that's 70% of our patients. They already have distant metastatic disease, such as in the brain, liver, adrenals, bones. This can also include malignant pleural effusion and pleural disease. So the prognosis, if you're limited and you can include radiation in your treatment with systemic treatment, now actually that's improved to almost 5 years, and I'm going to show you the data for that. The 3-year overall survival with this Adriatic trial is 56% of our patients. In extensive stage, unfortunately, the median overall survival is still just a little bit over a year. However, again, because of immunotherapy advances, we do have some patients that make it out further. The three-year overall survival in the Caspian trial is 18%. So we are in the current era of immunotherapy, even for small cell. I'm going to talk about these three trials. I'm going to start with the Adriatic trial for limited stage. So this trial was for patients with stage 1 through 3, limited stage, and they had already finished the concurrent chemo radiation. And they had to have had stable disease or a response. Then they were randomized to either durvalumab for 2 years, placebo, or Durva and Tremi. I'm not going to talk about that arm. Those results aren't back yet. So the primary endpoint is overall survival, and this is the Kaplan-Meier curve. And what you're looking for here is a big separation between the blue curve, that's durvalumab, and the red curve, which is placebo. And you definitely have a separation there. The hazard ratio is 7.73. What I really tell my patients is that this improves. If you do durvalumab consolidation for 2 years after concurrent chemo radiation, it's going to improve your survival for almost 2 years. So these patients are median overall survival 56 versus 33 months. So the PFS, progression-free survival, is also better by 7 months. And so because the study met these dual primary endpoints, this is now the new standard of care and has been approved by the FDA. This is what we're doing with our patients. So moving to extensive stage, this is my patient, 65-year-old African-American woman. She presented right before COVID with shortness of breath. There's her PET scan, a very large right lower lobe mass. Now, she had axillary lymph nodes that were involved, so that, you know, she couldn't get radiation, so she's extensive disease. And her treatment options are systemic, right? So the EMPOWER 133 trial, that's carbo, etoposide, atezolizumab times 4 cycles, followed by maintenance atezolizumab until progression or toxicities. And then the Caspian trial does the same thing but uses durvalumab or cisplatin. Now, some of these patients are sick and they present in the hospital and they can be treated with chemo. This is the EMPOWER 133 trial. It showed a benefit of 2 months. Very similar is the Caspian, again, 2 months, which you think, well, we wish it could be more. Well, it's really important that some of these patients actually do have a long-term effect, and in this case, it's the difference. We tripled the survival at 3 years between 6 with placebo and 18% with atezolizumab. And so my patient, actually going back to her, she was on maintenance atezo for 3 years. She stopped because she got COVID infection, and now she's been 2 years off of therapy with no evidence of disease. So that's really what we'd like to, that benefit is we'd like to get it to more patients. How do we do that? We really have to understand the biology and how small cell is different. They're different subtypes, not all that we, and then we can target some of those different subtypes with additional agents in the first line or metastatic setting. And of course, we have to improve our support of our patients through the journey. That's it.
So curious and really amazing case. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that that's typical to see that kind of response. I mean, do you see cure in small cell, in limited stage, for example? Do you see people who are, you know, are cured or even extensive stage? And is surgery ever used, Ann?
Yes. So and the aim of treatment in limited stage is cure. So we don't see that in all the patients, but you know, long-term survival past 5 years, we're thinking about, you know, 20, 25, even more percent of the patients. Your point about surgery is really key. So if they have node-negative disease, so just a spot in the lung that you can remove surgically, we do that. We have to sample the lymph nodes first to make sure there's no disease, but those patients actually do extremely well too, and I think they're cured.
I was just flashing on the fact this is the first time we've ever done a program just on small cell at ONS, and when you think about it, you said 16,000 cases. That's very similar to the incidence of CLL. Yeah. We talk about all the time, myeloma. So, you know, small subsets of extremely common cancers are important to consider. It's really interesting, too, that this tumor is so responsive to chemotherapy, and yet these patients typically relapse. We're going to go on and talk in a second about a case from Mass General. But just one other point, Beth. We mentioned the issue of tobacco in particular. Of course, the issue in general with lung cancer, non-small cell as well, but really a big issue here. Do you attempt to try to get patients to stop smoking? And what kind of strategies have you found useful?
We do. Quitting smoking not only is helpful for lung cancer, but also just for all their other comorbid conditions. If you think about it, I mean, they probably have underlying COPD and cardiovascular disease because they've smoked for a long time. And typically, the small cell patients have smoked a lot. Like, these are often your two-pack-a-day smokers. So if they can quit smoking, a lot of times, at least their comorbid conditions can calm down a little bit, which eases our ability to treat them. Now, our strategies for that, it's hard. We love the varenicline. That's the newer oral tablet. I say newer. It's probably been around for 10, 15 years now. And we have a smoking cessation clinic that's run out of Pulmonary at our institution, which, you know, uses drug therapy as well as, behavioral therapy as well to try to help them quit. We refer them. Whether they continue with the clinic is up to the patient, but...
Do you see a kind of regret expressed by patients and families? Does that come up, or people just sort of usually move on?
I think less so from families. I still think with patients, I mean, typically 2 out of 3 patients with small cell are male. And I think, you know, when they experience regret that they're going to, like, leave their families early, I do see that sometimes because, you know, small cell is still a very aggressive disease and the majority of patients are going to die from the illness. That being said, I think, you know, for me, we are there to focus on how we can help them improve their outcomes, and we try to keep a positive attitude about that.
You know, this is, again, a thematic issue in cancer in general, to try to deal with that when people are newly diagnosed smoking or whatever other potential issues are. So, Liz, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about some of the things you think about it, particularly as it relates to small cell and tarlatamab. Mm-hmm. But just to sort of dip our toe in the water, so to speak, tell us a little bit about this 63-year-old man.
Sure.
What happened with him? How did he present?
Sure. So this patient's a 63-year-old man, former smoker, diagnosed with extensive stage disease in January of 2022. He presented to a local emergency room with difficulty speaking and status post falls.
What was this a life situation? Did he have a family? Was he working?
So yes, he worked in accounting, well-educated, but lived alone. He had family, but he kept them at a distance. His sister, he allowed her to come to certain important visits, like scan reviews or changes in treatment planning, but otherwise he preferred to manage things himself. He was often very, he was anxious and suspicious, so it made sometimes going through the treatment planning a bit difficult.
How long ago had he quit smoking?
He had quit smoking, I believe, like 5 years prior to diagnosis.
Interesting. So I see he got the common first-line treatment for extensive disease.
He did.
And I assume you got radiation to the brain as well?
He did. He started. That was the first thing that was done. He had whole
and,
brain.
You know, when you see the use of immunotherapy as a part of first-line therapy, you don't see what you see in some of the high PD-1 patients with non-small cell who maybe are cured. As you saw the curves there, there was a benefit, but... maybe not quite as much as what you see in non-small cell lung cancer. He got that treatment. How did he do? Any IO immune issues?
So he did fairly well. He had standard chemotherapy side effects of nausea, fatigue, appetite changes, but he did experience skin toxicity that was immune-related that consisted of itchy skin, rash, and then he had lichenoid plaques that required him to take hydroxyzine TID, which ultimately we worried was impacting his mentation and level of alertness.
Beth, we hear a lot about skin changes with IOs. What are some? It seems like a lot of the patients have at least a little bit. What do you typically see?
I mean, in lung cancer, we don't typically see the severe rashes that maybe they see more commonly in melanoma, especially with dual checkpoint inhibitor therapy. I think in lung cancer, typically we're seeing the more mild rashes, pruritus, maybe a little bit of like flares of eczema, things like that. But I haven't seen a lot of, you know, really bad significant rashes.
So I see here a lot in November, actually, he had progression, not too surprising. It typically happens. Seems like pretty quick here. Mm-hmm. Now he's got liver mets, and he gets started on this bispecific that we talked about, tarlatamab. Anything you want to say about him as a person? You mentioned he's an accountant, that he's single. Anything else you want to say about kind of what the flavor was of treating him compared to other patients
sure,
with small cell?
Sure. He is a bit challenging with each encounter, and so we tried from a starting point to keep him seeing the same doctor and nurse practitioner for that, to keep a level of consistency in his care. Additionally, we considered his supports and encouraged him to involve his sister, especially as we plan to admit him to the hospital and needing to monitor patients following the infusion at home.
So let's talk just briefly. You know, again, we have four patients who got this therapy. We'll be able to compare how they did. So I guess this is just in December that he got started on tarlatamab. Can you kind of summarize about what happened when he got treated?
Sure. So cycle one, day one, he received the initial step-up dose, which is 1 milligram. That's given in our infusion room, and then patients are transferred to the hospital for observation. He did well with the treatment overall. He had mild nausea, diarrhea, and some fatigue. With cycle one, day eight, he did well during the treatment, but then upon returning home, he had a fall, which was reported several days later. So when he came back in for day 15 dosing, he was still unsteady on his feet. We were trying to assess his mental status, which was difficult in the setting of having had whole brain radiation and then multiple medications that he was taking that could impact his cognition. Because of his falls, we held the day 15 dose and brought him back to clinic the following week for consideration of more treatment.
So he actually had a response.
He did ultimately have a response, which was a little bit difficult for us to tease out because he had he did have some weight loss. He did have increased pain that we weren't sure, was this malignant pain or was this an exacerbation of his underlying arthritis in the setting of receiving tarlatamab?
Interesting. And what's his current situation?
And so now we did a spine MRI that showed degenerative changes because we were working up this increased pain. It does not show any metastatic disease, but he continues to fall and most recently fell in early April with head strike and went to a local emergency room. So we're now at a point of trying to figure out, is this some neurotoxicity or are these some side effects related to whole brain or other medications that he's taking? So our next step is to refer him to neuro for a more comprehensive neurologic workup.
Kind of curious, you know, palliative care being introduced in oncology in general really came out of lung cancer. Your institution, yeah. Mass General, Dr. Jennifer Temel, showing that actually people got early palliative care live longer with lung cancer. Has he gotten tied into a palliative care, or do you see that coming in the near future?
So I think he certainly needs it, but he's been resistant to
really?
That.
Really? So you wanted to recommend it, but you didn't want to do it?
We typically recommend it early on for any of our metastatic patients, whether it's to develop a relationship with the team for symptom management or just psychosocial support.
So, Beth, what about a pen? You use early palliative care?
So we do. Our situation's been a little different because we don't have the ability to handle the volume, basically. I mean, so they've really tried to incorporate palliative care within our primary oncology team, and then we're referring, you know, our more difficult symptom management patients to them. But it's just not a reasonable thing to be able to refer all of our patients to early palliative care. They would be so overloaded with patients.
So this is a great summary of some of the issues. And again, you have all the slides you can read, and we're not going to go through every little tiny point on it. But I'm curious about some of the comments you made down here at the bottom, operational. He prefers written communication to EMR. That's interesting. Yeah. Anything else you want to say about him? What makes it different taking care of him?
I think the written communication piece was really important, actually, for providers, too, so everybody knew exactly what we were telling him and that there was no confusion about, you know, this person said that about my pain medications. And so ultimately having things in writing is best for him and best for the team too. Another important piece is that he lives really far, far away, or 2 hours. I mean, certainly others travel further, but having to come into the hospital and be monitored for a 24-hour period of time, 2 weeks in a row, and then having to transition to outpatient monitoring, which can be very extensive and long. So for the first two cycles, the observation period is between 6 and 8 hours on top of the infusion itself and then whatever clinic visit you had plus labs. So those days are very long. It takes a toll on patients. They often struggle about, you know, their time, which is limited. So that can be a tricky piece.
I see. Also, you sent a visiting nurse services, but yet he sort of resisted it. He sounds like a challenging person to take care of.
He is. You know, despite our best efforts, he in recommendations he makes his own decisions, which we've been working with.
So anything you would say about some of the side effect management issues that kind of came up in him and come up in general in these patients?
Yeah, so some of this is general and applies to chemotherapy as well. We make sure that all the patients have a bowel regimen, they have antiemetics on hand, we encourage them to push fluids, but being mindful of fluid intake with small cell lung cancer that can often develop SIADH and hyponatremia, so that's a caveat to that recommendation. Nutrition consults, often patients develop taste changes on the drug, so using plastic utensils and ginger for nausea can be helpful. Eating candies for dry mouth, ibuprofen and Tylenol as needed. However, we are very clear that patients need to tell us and call us with any fever, because that could be CRS that occurs at home and just in a delayed way. So we're make sure that they have our phone number, the lines of communication are open, and we want to make sure that patients don't hesitate to or their families hesitate to report any symptoms.
It's interesting that you list fertility and sexuality counseling. We talked a lot about that already in our breast cancer session as well yesterday in prostate cancer, a huge issue. Interesting that you bring this up in this scenario.
Yeah, for women, I mean, small cell is not super common in women at younger ages, but it does happen. So we make sure that our patients know to use contraception throughout the course of treatment and then for 2 months following.
All right, well, let's sort of move further into it. Now we've kind of been exposed to the issue of small cell in general. Now, tarlatamab, and we're going to ask Anne to talk a little bit more now specifically about tarlatamab and relapse disease, which is, of course, where this man was treated.
Great. So we already talked about that this is a bispecific. In this case, it recognizes DLL3 protein on the surface of the tumor cell. Again, brings the immune system over to the tumor and really activates the T cells and tumor cell lysis. This is the Delphi 301 trial that was that led to the FDA approval for this drug. It was a study that had patients on two doses, the 10 milligram dose and the 100 milligram dose. I'm going to focus on the 10 because that was ultimately what was chosen for FDA approval. This is the baseline characteristics. I just want to point out that a third of these patients were heavily pretreated, so had 3 or greater lines of therapy. 73% had prior immunotherapy. So these are patients that have been treated with chemo and IO. Also noting that 23 of these patients had brain mets, but they were all treated. You had to have treated brain mets before you could enroll into the study. So the bottom line here is that 40% overall response rate. So that's terrific for this heavily pretreated population. If you add the stable disease there, then that means that your disease control rate is 70%. So that's terrific for these patients. The overall, the observed duration of response greater than or equal to 6 months was over 60% of the patients. So this was approved by the FDA. In May, we started treating patients, and then we, you know, are learning about this drug. So we talked a lot about CRS, grade 1-2, seen about 60% of the patients. So you really have to educate them around this. Grade 3 CRS, 3%. And if you look here to the right, you can see that most of the side effects occur at the during the right after the first or the second dose, so week 1 or week 2. And then much lower over there. And that's why most centers actually admit the patients after that, those two, in the first 2 weeks after administration for an observation stay. we really encourage our patients to be within 1 hour of a hospital for subsequent doses, although it's not always possible, and you really need reliable patients and caregivers. We talked a little bit about ICANS, so you can have confusion, cognitive deficit, or overall weakness, and that can happen any time throughout. It was pretty low, grade 1, 2 seen in 12% of the patients, and no grade 3 seen. Other side effects, loss of taste, dysgeusia, decreased appetite, nausea, neutropenia. Again, managed by supportive care, tocilizumab, or supportive care steroids, tocilizumab, oxygen, vasopressor support. ICANS is managed with steroids, and we always get our neurologic colleagues involved. Looking forward, this is a cohort of 30 patients who were monitored outpatient. So in the study, all of the patients needed to be monitored in the hospital 48 hours, except for this cohort. We presented it at ESMO IO, and now we published it. These patients did pretty well. Actually, if you look at the green versus the blue bars, blue is the 48-hour inpatient stay. The grade 1, grade 2, grade 3 is actually a little bit less, are pretty similar. So this is definitely possible to do it outpatient. There are centers that are doing this within the U.S., and we're working on it as well. So tarlatamab has really changed the landscape for relapsed small cell. It was approved for the second-line use and beyond, and I think on the right, that's the orange slide. That's what we're doing now. So second-line, we're really looking at tarlatamab and lurbinectedin, really the idea of platinum rechallenge has gone away. So a few words about lurbinectedin. That's the other agent that we use in the second line. This is chemotherapy. It binds to the minor groove DNA. It inhibits RNA transcription, and it causes DNA damage that leads to cell death. This is the trial that led to FDA approval. It was 105 patients with the relapsed small cell. The overall response rate was 35%. And so this led to accelerated FDA approval. The phase 3 confirmatory trial is ongoing. So how do you balance those factors for your patients between tarlatamab or lurbinectedin? In my mind, if the patient has chemo-resistant disease, so they had a shorter platinum-free interval, that's something where I'm really going to go for tarlatamab. I'm also looking at patients that are more robust. They have a better performance status. They're reliable. They have a caregiver that lives with them that can say they're not thinking right, they're not talking right today, and calling in. Again, if they live close by, that's going to be a lot easier, or if they have transportation. For lurbinectedin, I'm looking at, for my patients that are older, more frail, if they live alone, they have problems with transportation, this is an easy Q3-week IV treatment. So it's easier than what they had in first line because it's only one day instead of 3 days every 3 weeks. Again, these patients, if they're responding to chemo before, this is something that they can definitely respond to. And for us, we always put in a central line for them. I'm going to skip the cases because we're talking more about the case. I'll just end with the key points. I think that tarlatamab is really an exciting option to target the small cell immune desert or these cold tumors. Some of these patients, the overall survival, 9-10 months, that's much better than what we've seen in the past. The side effects can be managed. They're a little scary, but patients, and we'll hear more about them, they've had CRS, but they continue to do well. Lurbinectedin is a great tool, and Aaron's going to talk about other antibody-drug conjugates. I showed this picture of the different cookies because we sometimes think small cell is just one size fits all. It's all the same monolithic blue cells, but now we're really understanding more about the biology that there are subtypes that you can target as well.
I was trying to figure out what those cookies meant. I mean, I like it. Cool.
I got to add food.
Aaron, I was just flashing on when a few years ago we were presenting at a meeting for general medical oncologists, and we were talking about HMA venetoclax for AML, acute myelosuppression, and everybody in the audience was like, we're not going to give that. And now, they give it all the time. Same thing seems to be happening with bispecifics, and again, myeloma and lymphoma. It starts out in the community, and then sort of gingerly they start thinking about moving it into community-based practice. Do you see tarlatamab at some point, being initiated in a community-based setting?
I absolutely hope so. You know, in terms of just using this agent as standard of care along with some clinical trial agents, this is a new hope for these patients. And especially I want to highlight something that Anne brought up and mentioned in the clinical trial for tarlatamab, is that these patients who have chemo, you know, platinum resistant disease, which we classically think of as like a really aggressive bad actor, these patients don't have much in terms of survival. Tarlatamab and other agents are inducing a long, durable response in these patients, and that's really remarkable in terms of kind of what we now have to offer patients. So I hope that we are able to offer it to everyone who needs it, whether in an academic center or the community.
You know, another theme that we've been talking about this week is indirect comparison between different agents that haven't been compared in a trial. That happens all the time in oncology, which is, you know, challenging to do. And one of the things that's kind of like you see LERB having a response rate on paper that looks similar to tarlatamab, but when you actually see these patients, the duration of the response, the quality of the response, any difference? You think the responses are better with tarlatamab than LERB? Anne, do you want to comment on
that? Yeah, I think that, you know, for lurbinectedin, the duration of response really somewhere around 5-6 months. And for tarlatamab, it's much longer. And we're learning more. It's getting longer as we speak. I do think that this will be able to be used in the community. I think that it's going to be a lot of education, but these are side effects that you can manage through.
So, and we'll talk more about where this might be heading. You know, oncology, we start out late disease and try to move things up. Erin?
I was wondering if I could ask Anne a question about her trial with the outpatient management. Just curious, how many patients with small cell who came through the door would have been eligible for it? Because they needed, you know, reliable transportation and family members and other, you know, other like socioeconomic components that aren't always there for all of our patients.
It's a great point. I mean, I think clinical trials already cherry-pick patients that are robust and they have to meet all of these eligibility criteria, including they had to live within an hour. So,
yeah.
But we're learning from it. I think it's important.
So let's get back to a case. And Beth, you have a patient who received tarlatamab. Let's hear about it.
Sure. So this is a 70-year-old woman. She's deaf. She presented with chest pain, shortness of breath in January 2023. Typical with small cells that we see the nodal mass is actually larger than the primary often. And so she gets bronched and she's positive for small cell lung cancer. She gets a typical frontline therapy. She actually was limited stage to begin with. So she had gotten etoposide and platinum with four cycles concurrent with radiation to the chest that overlapped with cycle 3 and 4. She developed progressive disease in November. And if you guys look at that timeline, that's often typical, unfortunately, in small cell. Even though we treated her with curative intent, 10 months later, she was progressing already. And now she has a large 8 centimeters, a pretty large mass in the pelvis at this point. So she goes back to etoposide platinum and immunotherapy with atezolizumab for 4 cycles. And then that was followed by maintenance atezolizumab. She develops disease progression in August. So again, these are pretty common timelines here. This is a fast-moving disease. She developed brain mets shortly after that, was treated with whole brain radiation. She ended up getting radiation as well at the same time to the pelvic met. She then was put on lurbinectedin in November. She was put on lurbinectedin, back in August, and then by November was already progressing. So she started her tarlatamab in January of this year. So a little bit of background about this patient. She comes with her son. She lives alone. They come from Delaware to Philadelphia, which I kind of laughed about because I thought if you're not from the East Coast, you might be like, where is Delaware? It's actually not that far from Philadelphia. It's only about a 40-minute drive. But people are like, oh, the whole way from Delaware to Philadelphia? It's actually not that far. But anyway, but it hasn't been an issue for her family. Her son, and she also has a daughter, they're very dedicated to her. They want the best treatment for her. Her initial treatments were actually in Delaware, but when they were not able to give her the tarlatamab, they sought that out and came up to us at the University of Penn in Philadelphia. One thing is we need to have a sign language interpreter available at these visits. And that has made this really difficult because the sign language interpreter doesn't always show up. Mm. Typically, you know, when we're giving tarlatamab, we bring these patients in really early because this is a long day. You know, they get the infusion early in the morning. So I see them at 7:30. They come for 7 a.m. lab, 7:30 visit with me, and the interpreter's not always there, and it makes it difficult. She has learned a lot of trust with me. She said she reads my lips well. She told someone that. I'm like, oh, all right. I guess I maybe wear bright lipstick. I don't know. So she now refuses to see another nurse practitioner. So even if I'm away, she will delay until I'm back. And I'm sure you guys have experience with this as well. Like a patient comes back to infusion. They're like, nope, I only want her. She's the only one that can get my IV. So that sometimes causes, you know, some issues. But anyway, with her. So she got admitted for her monitoring of cycle one. Now, she had developed right arm pain that I had caught on to before we admitted her for her, we admit patients for their first day and second treatment of monitoring because it's a 24-hour monitoring time frame. So I had sent her for an x-ray on her way over to get admitted, and that showed a met in her right humerus. I'm like, ugh. Okay, well, we'll deal with that. We just gave you this, you know, big dose of tarlatamab. Now you're being admitted. Well, while she was admitted, just for CRS monitoring overnight, she got out of bed in the morning, and I think of this as, you know, she's deaf. She's not in her normal setting of her home, and she fell in the bathroom and fractured her right humerus. So this ended up requiring extended hospital stay, actually required surgery for a rod placement. She had some mild grade 1 CRS, which was just fever, but it ended up delaying the surgery, prolonging her hospitalization. So she ended up being discharged not for 2 weeks after her first tarlatamab dose. And so, and I'll just say the annoyance of this became, and Liz alluded to this in her first case, is that when these are delayed, we had to restart then her next dose at that step-up level at 1 milligram because there's a timing issue here, and I made a table there to show you that. So if your time from the first dose is more than 2 weeks, you then have to go back and give that first step-up dose again because of the sensitivity and the likelihood of developing CRS again. So instead of her only having to be admitted twice for step-up dosing and CRS monitoring, this ended up having to happen for her 3 times. I think my other big concern with her is that given that she's deaf, will I have a hard time assessing for ICANS in this patient? Because if you think about it, some of the things that we do to assess ICANS is we would say, if there's a clock in the room, like we'd point to it and say, you know, what is that? She doesn't speak well because she's deaf. So now I'm going to rely on the sign language interpreter pointing to that, but not telling her what that is in a sign language. And so some of these things I'm worried I might have a hard time. Plus the fact that she's had whole brain radiation. Am I assessing her cognition well? Because I'm assessing this through a sign language interpreter. So far, so good. I don't notice anything. I think I'm really going to rely on her children. Also, now they don't live with her, but they check on her frequently. They live close to her. So we really have to do a good job of educating the family about how we might identify signs of this.
Really interesting she had that pathologic fracture. Was she a smoker?
She was. Mm-hmm.
She currently when she was diagnosed?
No, she had quit. I don't remember exactly when she had quit because she didn't start her original care with us. It had been in Delaware, but she's not currently smoking.
So we're going to go on in a second and talk about future directions and where tarlatamab might fit in. But Beth, you know, for these many years that we've been coming to ONS, one of the themes we've had is what we call the bond that heals, which is the idea that going beyond any specific anti-tumor strategy that we might give to patients, patients really value the relationship that they have with you. And it certainly sounds like this is the case here. And from my point of view, it's maybe both ways. And I'm curious what it's been like for you to take care of her.
Yeah, I feel like I have a bond with her, too. I mean, hey, anyone that says they can read my lips well, like, you stole my heart. So, but, you know, I think that we've both really developed this close bond, and I think it's been really helpful because this drug in particular, there are nuances that you have to really be able to tease out, especially when it comes to ICANS and certainly CRS monitoring as well. And there's a lot of patient education and family education that goes on here when they're not here in the office with you. So I think that bond has been, you know, really particular and helpful here.
So we're going to move on now and talk a little bit about where things might be heading in small cell management. Erin.
Great. Thank you. And this has been so exciting to see over the past few years. You saw Neil show a slide of the bispecifics that are in the hematologic space, and finally it's coming to the solid tumor space. And there are a lot of cancer types that are very deserving of breakthroughs. Small cell definitely is one of them. So I'm excited to see what we've been able to develop so far for our patients. And there are a couple of themes I'll touch on. I won't go over all targets, all therapies, all response rates, but we're able to start to get more mileage for our patients from our therapies, thanks to identifying new targets on the surface of the small cell lung cancer cells. So there's a number of agents in development, ADCs in particular, against several cell surface targets. I'll speak more about B7H3, but you can kind of see a number of those targets listed as well as the associated ADC. And then, of course, there's these novel immune-based therapies. These T-cell bispecifics are one of them, but also, as we mentioned briefly earlier, CAR T-cell therapy may also be coming through for our patients with small cell lung cancer. So, focusing on tarlatamab specifically, a number of trials are being developed to really cement the role of tarlatamab in different spaces within the treatment paradigm for small cell lung cancer. So Delphi 304, really is the phase 3 confirmatory trial to solidify tarlatamab as a subsequent line setting for patients with small cell lung cancer that's underway. Delphi 305 is looking at the first line setting where patients receive a chemo IO therapy appropriate for a first line presentation of extensive stage small cell lung cancer. And then they'll be randomized to either PD-L1 alone or PD-L1 plus tarlatamab. And then, like many of these agents, the companies are very much thinking about how do we move these agents earlier on in a disease stage, in a disease course. This is Delphi 306. And the way the trial was designed is patients would have, appropriate concurrent chemoradiation for limited stage small cell lung cancer, and then be randomized to either tarlatamab or placebo. And this is one of the bad things about being first out the gate, is because our standard of care has since changed for limited stage small cell lung cancer since this trial was written and started. We now give durvalumab after concurrent chemo radiation in limited stage small cell lung cancer. So it'll be a little hard to interpret these results when they do come out. There are several DLL3 CD3 T-cell engagers in development for small cell lung cancer. This is just a collection of some of them. And I think what will be really interesting over time in terms of drug development is they're able to modify the sticky end that grabs onto the T-cell so that it doesn't grab so tightly. And I think this is really important because that will reduce the overall immune activation as well as the potential for CRS. But those are still in development, so maybe one day we won't have to hospitalize folks or CRS will be a memory of the past. Several other agents in development, DLL3 T-cell engagers. This is one from Boehringer. I think it has a name. I'm not going to try it. It's too early for me. I'm from Colorado.
Obrey.
But you're able to see that there are, good levels of response in this heavily pretreated subsequent line population. And there's ongoing trials very similar to the development strategy for tarlatamab, looking at this agent in different phases of therapy. So not only small cell lung cancer, but other neuroendocrine tumors also express DLL3. So that's one of the clinical trials. They're combining this agent in the first line setting, and they're also treating it in a refractory setting with topotecan in combination. This is a Merck drug, MK-6070. This is also a therapy targeting small cell lung cancer, and they included other neuroendocrine tumors that express DLL3 in their cohorts, and they're seeing a level of response across these histologies and across these tumor types. And I want to shift just briefly to talking about IDXD. It's a B7H3 targeting ADC. early phase 2 data in patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer have been promising, and let me show that to you. So these were patients that already received, you know, appropriate first line therapy, and they were comparing different dose levels of this agent in this phase 2 clinical trial, and they saw a pretty good response rate again for subsequent line small cell lung cancer. They were seeing, you know, 26% in the lower dose cohort and, 55% in the higher dose cohort. And the reason I bring this up is we hinted at this before. In very broad strokes, these new novel ADCs targeting these, you know, new targets in small cell lung cancer often have a pretty impressive response rate for our patients. Again, early data, but hopefully that holds true. What they don't have, and Anne referenced this, is they don't have a duration of response similar to novel immune therapies like tarlatamab. So what this particular trial is doing, and likely other companies are going to do as well, is find a way to combine the DLL3 T-cell engagers with these novel ADCs to try to get that response rate, so get more patients into response, and then allow the patients to have a more durable response with the T-cell engager. So the future is here. We're getting close, and I'm really excited for it. And some of the barriers we've touched on, and I think I'll just go to my last slide to talk about what are the challenges with trying to enroll patients onto these clinical trials. So we've talked a bit about the hospitalization requirement. With the combination of the T-cell engagers and the ADCs, we're still at Q1 week, 2 week, 3 week dosing for these T-cell engagers. And then when you can try to combine them with ADCs, because they can have a number of different dosing regimens. They could be day 1, day 8, every 2 weeks. This particular one, that clinical trial I highlighted, the T-cell engager, once you're sort of in maintenance mode, is every 2 weeks. The ADC is every 3 weeks. That's a really challenging infusion, appointment scheduling. They're not all given together. They're given in a staggered fashion. So it's a lot of visits for patients. And some of these other items we can talk about as a discussion, but I'll stop here.
So, Anne, question from the audience. I'm going to ask you to address in a second. And any other side effects of tarlatamab other than CRS and ICANS? But I wanted to just point out one thing about, if we can go to that. Yeah, there you go. Just to clarify, just again, thematically, this is called a waterfall plot, for those of you who don't know. And each one of these bars is a patient. And if the bar is going up, it means the tumor is getting bigger. If it's going down, it means it's getting smaller. So when you see a waterfall plot where most of the patients, again, each one is a patient going down, that's favorable as well. So again, Anne, any other side effects with tarlatamab?
Yeah, you have loss of taste. That's something that really has been remarkable, like no taste, similar
really?
To the COVID, yeah. And that's something that you really have to get used to, because you don't have the same sort of drivers to eat. You can have decreased appetite because of that. Neutropenia in about 12% of the patients. You can have a handful of some nausea, diarrhea, but that's very low level. But that really has impressed me for my patients. Just can't taste.
Interesting.
And so, that's gone away after they went on to another therapy, so...
So also, I noticed one of the trials you talked about is tarlatamab plus a checkpoint inhibitor. Mm-hmm. That sounds like it might be kind of interesting. I have no idea what kind of tolerabilities you get when you put those two together. Is there any data on that right now? I'm curious about how that plays out.
We have that open. We're going to start a patient next week, actually. I think that they're overlapping in a different way. They both have to do with the immune system. But, for example, some patients who you wouldn't give our traditional anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1 immunotherapy because they have ILD or some sort of autoimmune disease, that seems to be okay with tarlatamab. We're not specifically tickling the immune system in that way to ramp that up, for example, to get a flare of rheumatoid arthritis. So they're different.
So, Beth, really exciting idea, Beth, to try to use tarlatamab as maintenance in the first-line setting, but that's going to change the maintenance experience quite a bit. right now, I guess they just get an IO in maintenance, and now we're going to look at bringing in Torlatimab with all these issues. Any thoughts about how that's going to play out?
Well, you're right. Logistically, it would be different. Side effect-wise, it would be different. I mean, I think that remains to be seen, and I don't think we're there yet. We need to see what clinical trial data shows. But, yeah, it would definitely change a lot for the patient. But I think once they would then get into the maintenance part of it, I mean, you know, once you get through those first couple cycles where you have the overnight admission, they often are on autopilot then every 2 weeks, and the drug is pretty well tolerated then at that point.
I'm the eternal optimist. I always think things are going to work, and sometimes they do. All right, let's get back to another case, Liz. This is an 81-year-old man, history of prostate cancer. That's interesting. We had a whole session on that yesterday. It's typical comorbidities you see in an older man. He was a smoker?
Yes, heavy smoker, 2 packs a day for many years. And he presented to a local hospital after a mechanical fall in the context of a 20-pound unintentional weight loss, cough, and found to have a mild transaminitis on labs. Imaging demonstrated a large lung mass with other subpleural nodes and significant hepatic disease burden. He had a liver biopsy that demonstrated small cell lung cancer and was started on standard therapy with atezolizumab for 4 cycles and unfortunately progressed before starting maintenance atezo. Mm-hmm. So he was then started on lurbinectedin. It came at a time. He progressed right around when tarlatamab was approved, but we didn't have our standard of practice developed at that point, so we put him on lurbinectedin for the time being, and unfortunately, in short order, he progressed in his liver and developed new brain metastases. So by July, we had developed our standard of practice, and we were ready to start him on tarlatamab.
And just pointing out, similar to Beth's case, this man went from first-line therapy to third-line therapy in 5 months.
Yeah.
You don't typically see that, so it reflects how aggressive this disease can be. What was his life situation?
So he was currently single male, but the primary caretaker for his 17-year-old great-granddaughter.
Wow.
Who lived with him. He could be challenging in clinic. He was very regimented, a former Marine, and if anything was late or if he wasn't seen early, it sort of, he was thrown for a loop.
Hmm.
And then when we thought about his home life, he was the primary caretaker. There wasn't many people around to support him and to check in on him. His healthcare proxy was his landlord, and so we made contact with his landlord prior to discharge from the hospital to make sure that he would agree to check in on him daily and knew how to reach us.
Did you meet his daughter? His granddaughter?
No, so I never met her. She was always in school, and that also presented some challenges because once he had transitioned to outpatient therapy, he needed to get home to get her off the bus and be home. So he was very anxious, and we ultimately worked with him. Once his monitoring period was shorter, we did delinked visits, so he would come and see us and then come back the next day.
One of the things we talked about for years here at ONS is minor children and grandchildren.
Yeah.
Of patients with cancer. Do you have any specialized services at MGH?
So we involve social work. He said that he had appropriate legal support and that things were in place should he pass because she was still a minor. So we wanted to make sure that she was protected and safe during his treatment course.
So what happened when he got the tarlatamab?
So he was admitted for the step-up dosing cycle on day one. He developed a grade 2 CRS, which with fever to 104, with associated hypotension and new oxygen requirement up to 2 liters. So at that time, we supported him with Tylenol, ibuprofen, and Demerol for Rigors. We gave him dexamethasone, 8 milligrams IV, Q8 hours times 2.
He was in the ICU?
Nope, he was on the floor because he did not need pressure support. His pressures came up but were still soft with the IV fluids. And so when things were not turning around quick enough, then we reached for the tocilizumab. So tocilizumab is dosed 8 milligrams per kilogram, infused over an hour. It's a single dose. And he recovered and turned around and did quite well.
What's his current situation?
So now he is... I'll skip past that. We covered what tocilizumab is. So his current situation is that he's had a great response. He's had marked improvement in his hepatic disease burden, as well as a response in the CNS.
Wow.
Which is something that we're very excited about. We haven't seen it with all of our patients, but it's something that's very important given the propensity of small cell to metastasize to the brain.
Yeah, we always have this concept of so-called blood-brain barrier, but a lot of the immunotherapies, even ADCs, seem to work in the brain. So that sounds like a great, at least, beginning here. Anything else you want to say about him and the challenges of managing this particular patient?
Sure. So as we touched on, a lot of patients with small cell lung cancer have comorbid conditions. He was a diabetic on 5 agents, but having had so much weight loss in the setting of progressive disease, he presented with hypoglycemia on the admission for tarlatamab. So he was a captive audience. It gave us the opportunity to involve endocrine and to manage some of his comorbid conditions in that short period of time. Other things that came up, so we often discuss code status or advanced directives, especially in the setting of progressive extensive stage disease. And so when he was being admitted to the hospital, we talked about, would he want to be DNR, DNI? But he was very hung up, understandably, on the reversibility of some of the side effects that with CRS and ICANS that, maybe he would get to the point of needing to be intubated, though unlikely, but he felt like this could be reversed, and understandably. So he elected to be full code. And now that things have stabilized and he's out, he's receiving treatment as an outpatient, that those risks are very low, and the small cell in general is the higher risk to taking his life. So those code status discussions are ongoing.
Beth, any thoughts about this full code thing? Kind of interesting. 81-year-old man, comorbidities and brain mets, et cetera.
Yeah, I never thought about it until this case, and you just said that. And I was thinking, wow, you're right, though. These patients with CRS can become, quickly really hypotensive, but we can reverse it very quickly with steroids or toci. Mm-hmm. So it's the whole touch-and-go thing. Yeah. It's like, well, yeah, you're right. I wouldn't want to just be like, well, he's DNR, so we'll just, let him pass peacefully when a little bit of steroids and toci could turn this around quickly. So yeah. I never thought about it until now. But, yeah, that actually makes sense, I think, in this case. Though, I think what I was thinking personally is the patient could still be a DNR, but very specifically communicated in that if there were cardiac arrest, then they would not resuscitate him. But if he's hypotensive and even requires pressors for a short time, that may be something that he would want. So I think there would need to be a more extensive discussion about the actual DNR status.
So question from the audience, Anne, do the taste changes reverse? And I'll ask you, is this similar to the taste issue you see with COVID?
Yeah, I think a little bit because they just can't taste. And my patients who have been on tarlatamab, who had this side effect and then went on to another therapy, did regain some of their taste. So that did come back.
We have a great audience here. Somebody just sent me a paper on the phase 1B study of tarlatamab plus what we just talked about, IO. And looks like maybe this is tarlatamab as maintenance. With this study, idea that you talked about, I guess a preliminary study to see how well it was tolerated, a really interesting strategy. Looks like these patients did pretty well. All right, so let's move on now. We're going to get into some further discussions in terms of some specific, unique considerations in the management of a small cell that you can see in other cancers, but much more common in small cell. And when you see these kinds of issues, it makes things even more interesting. Aaron?
Yeah, thank you. So there definitely are some interesting ways that small cell lung cancer can manifest and present that can affect patients and quality of life. And you can see it. And often with chemotherapy, you can help it really quickly. So that's the good news. So in speaking about small cell lung cancer, these arise from neuroendocrine cells. And they, as we've kind of talked about some of the epidemiology, often there is a significant tobacco use history, mediastinal nodes, hilar nodes, often bulky and large. And this is a disease that's highly proliferative, fast-growing, fast-moving. And I'll talk about a couple of these clinical issues that we can see in patients newly diagnosed with small cell lung cancer. So some of the broad categories that we think about are paraneoplastic syndromes, and these are syndromes that can come up because of the cell of origin. These neuroendocrine cells especially, they're sort of adept at making various hormones, bioactive substances that can act as if they are, you know, the hormones of the target organ. They can also express shared antigens that generate an autoimmune response that can be through B cells or autoantibody production, and more severely, sometimes autoreactive T cells can also be generated to these antigens. A couple of the syndromes down here that are most common, SIADH, as well as Cushing syndrome. And I want to talk through SIADH and a patient I'm taking care of right now with a rapid response. So this was a patient who was having a slow recovery from COVID about a year back with cough, dyspnea, and she also reported she was just having this low level of nausea and occasionally vomiting. You know, sometimes we can see long-term GI effects from COVID, but this was just, you know, persisting. Eventually, because of her history of smoking as well as her symptoms, she had imaging, and a left upper lobe mass was identified. Eventually, we diagnosed her with extensive stage small cell lung cancer, and she was started on chemoimmunotherapy. And just before that, she had a sodium of 124 and a very high urine osm, about, you know, greater than 600, really inappropriate for that level of sodium. Started her on chemoimmunotherapy, and I remember seeing her prior to cycle two, and she says to me, "My nausea has gone away. This is amazing." And what we saw through, you know, the initial therapy is that her sodium levels, and that's what this chart is demonstrating here, is they went back in the normal range, this blue bar. Unfortunately, some other medical issues came up, and we had to interrupt her treatment because of hospitalization. Her sodium levels went down as her disease became active again, and we've restarted her on therapy, and again, the sodium is starting to level out. It's a little more tricky the second time.
Before you go on, yeah. Can you kind of explain your vision of the syndrome? You were talking about syndrome of ADH secretion, like what the pathophysiology is that leads to the low sodium.
Prevents the way I think about it and talk to patients about it is that this extra release of hormone by the cancer cells prevents sort of the normal regulation of sodium within the body. And that really happens in the kidneys, that sodium balance. So when you have all of this extra basically hormone coming out of the cancer cells, your body can't regulate it normally. So when your body can't regulate the sodium normally. So when we're able to attack the cancer cells, take that extra hormone away, kind of your normal levels get restored.
And in patients with severe hyponatremia, do you ever use saline? Do you restrict fluids?
You know, in my clinical experience, you know, in other situations, yes, we absolutely can. Often with any sort of hyponatremia, what you see when you look online, like UpToDate.com, it says, you know, treat the underlying disease. And so, you know, by often in small cell lung cancer, treating the underlying disease with chemotherapy, chemoimmunotherapy as needed, really helps to reset that osmostat, reset that level of sodium.
Really interesting, though, when her treatment gets interrupted, her sodium went back down.
Mm-hmm. And she also became nauseated and started, unfortunately, having some balance difficulties, too.
How about SVC syndrome?
SVC syndrome, so usually it's because of some sort of mediastinal mass pressing on the superior vena cava. And you can often see this, and patients will report feeling swollen in the head and the face. As you examine them, you might notice that there's some dilation of the vessels within the upper body and the arm. They can also have upper extremity edema. You know, this illustration, you know, really helps to capture some of those key features. There's a facial fullness, and often they will tell you this. They will say, "My face is swollen," and it's just it hasn't gone down on its own, as well as examining the chest wall and some extremities, you can see these sort of dilated tortuous vessels. This is just an imaging example showing a patient with a mediastinal mass, the SVC being compressed right here. So it really prevents that normal blood flow, preventing that really causes that edema to happen within the face. So really, again, just like SIADH, other paraneoplastic syndromes, treating the underlying disease. Small cell lung cancer is one that responds so quickly. Sometimes we can start chemotherapy and see a response before our colleagues in radiation oncology are able to do their simulation and start, their radiation therapy as well. Often at my institution, we do concurrent chemo radiation, especially for SVC syndrome, just, knowing that it needs quick active treatment. For some of the other diseases, for example, if this was a lymphoma, steroids make sense. Occasionally stenting can be done as well. But again, it all depends on what is the underlying disease or etiology of why the SVC is compressed. So this one is one of the final major considerations with management of patients with small cell lung cancer. Lady I take care of, she lives about an hour away from campus, and she's really scared of driving on the freeway. So she actually hides in the back of the car while her husband drives to campus. But her family is very dedicated, and they bring her, and she has someone with her all the time. But she was going through lung cancer screening based on her smoking history, and a left upper lobe nodule was identified. Eventually, it was determined she has small cell lung cancer, and because of osseous metastases, it was extensive stage. And she received first-line therapy in April, just on the dot with the progression-free survival that we see with the chemo-IO therapies in first-line. She then developed a recurrence of her disease. And I enrolled her on a clinical trial for a T-cell engager, as you see here. And again, look at that duration of response. She had a full year of response on this T-cell engager therapy. And as you remember back to Anne's, one of her initial presentations, these patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer really are only thought to live about a year with the chemo immunotherapy when that came out. Their overall survival was about a year. But this patient was able to get a year of survival from this therapy. She had progression, and just a single-sided progression. We're the Wild West out here in Colorado, so she actually underwent surgical resection because she had no evidence of disease anywhere else. So continues on surveillance, and I should say surveillance includes full-body imaging as well as brain MRIs. And unfortunately, not too long ago, she presented to a local ED for left-sided weakness and confusion. And what was seen, and she previously at diagnosis did not have brain metastases, but had since developed brain metastases. And she is and has completed SRS to the lesions that were found. So the really challenging thing about small cell lung cancer is the propensity for brain metastases to develop. Over half of our patients will likely develop brain metastases. Why, other than the diagnosis of small cell lung cancer, that's a huge risk factor, but what else influences who does develop metastases, who doesn't, isn't clear. And it's more likely, just like in my patient case I just presented, to have multiple metastases. We can continue to think about something called prophylactic cranial irradiation. There was an older study that randomized patients to receiving basically whole brain radiation therapy prophylactically or not. There was a suggestion from the data that overall survival was improved in the patients that received whole brain radiation therapy. But if you really want to get an academic thoracic oncologist like me to get their feathers ruffled, there were some trial design issues. Patients weren't appropriately staged in their CNS prior to trial enrollment, which had to do with the era of this trial. So we're really trying to think about how do we improve control of brain metastases while balancing the side effect profile that can happen with prophylactic whole brain radiation therapy? A trial is going on right now through the a cooperative group to understand whether in the modern setting PCI is necessary or whether just regular brain MRI imaging is sufficient to help watch for brain metastases. While we have some promising data coming out with, you know, tarlatamab and ADCs, we don't have a great agent that we give systemically that we know can guarantee will take care of brain metastases. And with radiation, of course, we're shifting towards SRS based on some non-inferiority data. But, you know, the challenge is, of course, radiation necrosis when you need whole brain radiation therapy and just trying to reduce that side effect profile for whole brain.
What do you typically see in terms of side effects or effects of whole brain radiation, and when do you see it, Aaron?
So I have a patient who remarkably has survived for a number of years post needing whole brain radiation therapy. I think one of the first things that he started having challenges with was dry mouth. So, of course, some of the radiation fields can affect the salivary glands. So there was dry mouth. There was a little more trouble with word recall that he's had. And he also developed cataracts. This gentleman has been out for a number of years from whole brain radiation therapy. So he needed to have cataracts taken care of. So again, all these long-term side effects. But he's had great CNS control.
A couple quick questions from the audience. And does vaping impact the risk of lung cancer? Do we know anything about that?
Oh, that's interesting. There's a lot of data that's starting to come out of that, and I think it does affect your lung function. The direct tie to lung cancer, I think, is not yet, at least I'm not aware of it, but it's actively being studied. Great question.
Another question from the audience, Liz, a question of the use of remote home monitoring for CRS. Is that something you think you ever use or you think might be useful?
I think that's a great idea. It's not something that we're using, but it's something that makes a lot of sense. We've thought about making sure that patients have an automatic blood pressure cuff at home, a thermometer, and like a way to check those vital signs so we know, is it just a fever or is it a fever with hypotension at home, which requires a different intervention. So I think that's a great idea.
All right, well, let's finish out with another case. I feel like we're making rounds here today. And, you know, all of our work is based on rounds. Like when I was an intern, I loved going on rounds. And that's the way we design our program. So, Beth, let's hear about this 67-year-old woman.
Yeah, so a lot of this case tags off of what we all just talked about. So this is a 67-year-old female diagnosed with extensive stage small cell in June of 2022. Her presentation was facial swelling and cough that was not necessarily out of the ordinary. But she had a scan, and you can see it there. There's a large mass, and I put the heart there because sometimes we kind of forget where the superior vena cava was because we've been in oncology so long. So her, this large centralized mass, which is very typical of what we see in small cell lung cancer, was impacting this woman's superior vena cava. So she was bronched and found that this was small cell, and she has superior vena cava syndrome. So that tumor is pressing on that superior vena cava. There's basically a backflow of blood flow to the upper extremities and the face, causing her symptoms. She was inpatient at the time of this, so they were able to get her really quick palliative radiation. But Dr. Shank made a really good point. Like, we could have just started chemo as well. Chemo works very quickly with these patients. But she was there. They were able to hit this with 3 fractions of radiation really quickly to get her some symptom relief. She was also found to have brain mets at diagnoses as well, and she had stereotactic radiosurgery to 3 of these brain lesions. So again, just a quick recap of her treatments. So in September of 2022, she had chemo immunotherapy followed by maintenance immunotherapy. She progressed in June of 2023 and had a new brain met at progression. So again, that was treated. She started lurbinectedin chemotherapy in October, shows a response to the lurbinectedin and resolution of the brain met without radiation at that time. February 2024, she progresses, and we went back to chemo immunotherapy at this point, progressive brain mets. She developed, now she got whole brain radiation. So she first had stereotactic, now she's had whole brain. So she's had two brain radiation treatments. And then October of 2024, progression in the chest and new liver met. And we started tarlatamab on her in December of last year. So we reviewed with her family the risk of CRS and what it may look like and ICANS. We reassured them this most commonly occurs within the first two doses, and she will be monitored inpatient. The ICANS, again, similar to my first patient, I didn't voice this out loud, but I'm thinking in the back of my head, she's had stereotactic brain radiation and whole brain radiation. At baseline, her cognition was definitely off to some degree. I mean, she could answer questions appropriately, but she wasn't real sharp. A lot of times she would look at her husband, like when I would ask a question. Sometimes he would answer, sometimes she would. So she has our first treatment, December 10th, tolerated pretty well, no real side effects. The second treatment, which is now the step-up dose of the 10 milligrams, she developed CRS while admitted for overnight monitoring. She had fever that was complicated by hypotension. She developed lethargy as part of this. And though she was admitted, her daughter was actually the one who stayed overnight with her. And her daughter was like really sort of traumatized by watching this, even though she was in an inpatient setting. She was treated with acetaminophen, dexamethasone, IV fluids, and she did quickly improve in 24 to 48 hours, and she actually was discharged on the third day. So, and then after that, we treated her, you can see, on Christmas Eve, and she tolerated treatment number three very well as an outpatient. So going back to her CRS response and her experience with it, you know, this is why we do the step-up dosing. The 1 milligram on day 1, the 10 milligrams on day 8. And you can see that I used the same slide that you did, Dr. Chang. I did use the same graphic here to show from the paper that the majority of it happens either on day 1 and then day 2. It's very rare to be grade 3, 4, so the majority of it is going to be that grade 1, 2. It did occur in over half of the patients. Grade 1 is fever only. Grade 2 is fever plus one of these complicating factors. So I would just say the thing that took me by surprise with this one was that her daughter, when they came in for dose 3, I said, oh, I saw she had CRS, but she got better quickly. And the daughter was like, that was really upsetting. I was so worried. She couldn't even like talk to me properly. And here I was thinking, you know, well, I warned you about it, but I probably learned from that experience that I warn the families a little bit more. This may look scary to you, even though they're inpatient, and I'm thinking, well, they're inpatient. We'll take care of it. The family doesn't know that. You know, this is their first experience with this. And when they see their mother, like, not being able to respond and talk, and you know, the machines are beeping, and it was really upsetting to her. And she wasn't, like, mad, but she was just kind of sharing that experience. So I'm a little bit more now when I say, hey, this CRS, it actually can be serious and frightening, but we know how to manage it. Generally, almost all the time, we're going to be able to make this go away and get better very quickly.
That's a great point. What happened with her severe vena cava syndrome? It's not like going way back to the beginning.
That got better very quickly.
And she just had facial swelling?
Hers was mostly facial swelling, though I do feel like the irritating cough may have been part of it as well.
Liz, any final comments hearing Beth talk about the family involvement?
No, I think just emphasizing when you're just the education can't just be to the patient. It needs to be to a supportive family member. Everybody needs to hear it because if the patient's doing unwell at home, there needs to be that support and they need to be able to recognize symptoms and know who to call.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. Follow this podcast for more great content and edutainment on Oncology Nursing Update.